For the week of August 23rd, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 291, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Are we really going to do a show? I mean, nobody cares about box office after what happened.
Are you talking about just the fact that it's August and, you know, it's kind of a usually
I'm talking about One Direction breaking up. Nobody cares about anything else.
Remind me who One Direction is again.
Oh, shut up.
I'm just kidding. Well, I don't know if they broke up.
The band is dead.
I don't know if they've broken up. But of course, this news kind of, no pun intended, it broke just as we sat down to record.
Yes, and they're all going their separate ways.
Are they? Or is it going to be like The Who or like Fleetwood Mac? They kind of break up. They go do their separate shows. And
well, that's what they said. They said Harry's going to do movie. This guy's going to do TV. That guy's going to be on the panel for X Factor in the UK. And then they'll all get back together, but it'll never be the same.
Well, I mean, you know, other bands have done that. Look at like Genesis with Phil. Oh, that's a bad idea.
That's a bad idea.
Phil Collins. Yeah.
No. Shush.
The Police?
If we're going to do the show, let's do the show.
Okay, fine. Should we tell people, though, before we start, that you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, anywhere they give podcasts away for free? Should we tell them that?
Absolutely. Harry's got time on his hands. Why doesn't he listen to our podcast?
Yeah, or he can contact us via Twitter. Just look up at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Our Facebook page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Of course, you can always email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. So you can...
And Harry, my personal number is 917 bleep, 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 bleep.
Okay, actually, I thought you were going to say 555-1212 or something silly like that.
Oh, no. So if he does listen to the show, what will he hear about?
Well, on this week's show, after years of denying that cord cutting was at all a quote-unquote thing that is happening on any level... Well, media companies are finally confessing, mostly via their earnings reports, by the way, that cord cutting is a trend which has grown enough to affect their bottom lines. Indeed, the television space is evolving rapidly, more so than, say, movies or theater or even publishing at this moment. Maybe that's why NBC decided to invest $200 million to the upstart online outlet BuzzFeed, which I know is Michael's favorite website, but NBC is doing this in hopes of attracting millennials, a.k.a. cord nevers. So you see, they never had cords to cut. So they
except
need to...
the umbilical cord.
Yes. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of recent shootings in cinemas, one North American movie theater chain has found a way to make its multiplexes more secure.
No, they haven't.
Well, all they have to do is search your bag before you enter.
Doesn't help.
Hey, at least you get to keep your shoes on. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first... As always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link from RentTrack. We pull information from Box Office Profits and Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, LA Times, you name it. And if your movie isn't on this list, if you have a big hit in your territory, use that contact information we gave you above and send us links to information on that movie that's a big hit in your territory. Because sometimes they don't make enough box office to make it onto the worldwide chart, but they are a big hit in certain individual countries. So if you've got a box office smash in your country and we haven't mentioned it, let us know about it. But right now, the number one movie around the world everyone has heard about, it's the new Mission Impossible film starring Tom Cruise, another $37 million over the weekend. It's at $440 million and counting. At number two, Arnold Schwarzenegger is very happy because China said ni hao to Terminator Genesis. Another $27 million, a big opening in that territory, one of the biggest of all time, and certainly the biggest for Terminator, that franchise. It made $27 million over the weekend. It's at $350 million worldwide. Still not a hit, but at least, you know, they're claiming some respectability. I mean, the movie cost $155 million to make, so it needs to make about $450 just to sort of feel like it's going to break even.
Well, theatrically, that is. Yes.
Right. Yeah. There's always ancillary, and that can make up for shortfalls. But if you want to say this film has been a big success, you want to make your money at the box office, right? Even though we know there's a lot more money to be made down the line. Certainly right out of the box, Straight Outta Compton is a success. That had a $30 million budget. It made that practically this weekend alone, $27 million over the weekend, almost all of it in North America. It's made $111 million worldwide. But when all is said and done, it'll probably make $170 million in the U.S. It's only made $170,000 overseas. Well, that's because it hasn't really opened up yet. But it'll be fun to see how wide they open this, how many countries go into it, how much money it makes, because this is a good film with good reviews. It should play well around the world. But of course, we know there's a prejudice against films starring black actors and about black storylines. And we'll have to see if this is one of the few to cross over. There have been plenty of examples in the past, action, romance, drama, you name it. There should be plenty in the future. This is a good test case.
I agree. And I think Universal Pictures would be foolish not to open this film.
May have sold it off overseas.
Oh,
who knows?
True.
I mean, it's in four territories, but you know, however it's been distributed overseas. And I shouldn't call it a test case. It's just another movie. It's a good movie with good reviews and it's making good money. So, you know, why wouldn't you want to show it in your territory? And number four is Bride Wars. No, it's not the Kate Hudson, Anne Hathaway comedy. It's a Chinese remake of the Kate Hudson, Anne Hathaway comedy. It opened in that territory. It made $23 million on its opening weekend.
Now, to give you some sense, I totally forgot that was a movie that was made in the U.S. first. So that should tell you how successful it was here.
I don't know. What was its box office?
I don't know. I'll look it up while you move on.
You look
it
up.
One.
But number five is Fantastic Four. We know that cost about $125 million to make, and nobody's happy about the result. It made $20 million over the weekend. Is at $130 million worldwide. So it's just starting to match its box office. It's going to make more overseas than in the U.S., but it needs to make a lot more. In the U.S., it has really fallen hard. It's just made $50 million total. It's almost out of the top 10 if it isn't already. No, it's still in the top 10, but it won't be probably next week. So as we've all discussed ad nauseum, whatever plans they made, whatever road they got to, the final film is not a good one, and it's not going to make a lot of money. At number six is a spinoff from a video game. It's called Hitman, Agent 47. This stars Mr. 47, of course, the cloned assassin. It made $16 million on its opening weekend, about half of it in the U.S., half of it overseas.
Well, I guess I should just shut up because the budget cost an estimated $30 million for Bride Wars, and it made $58.7 million here in the U.S., so I guess I'm wrong.
But it made worldwide.
Oh, I knew you were going to ask
that. Who cares about you? We want to know the world. It's like saying what it made in Oklahoma. That's the whole point of our world box office chart.
Well, I know, but was worldwide really a
thing?
A thing back in 2009
or whatever it came out. I think it was a thing. Yeah.
Oh, come on. Worldwide, it made $114 million.
All right. So it tripled, almost quadrupled its budget.
Yes.
So that's pretty darn good. That's why they made a remake.
I guess.
At number seven around the world is The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Not a great success story so far. It made $15 million over the weekend. It's at just past $50 million worldwide. We'll have to see where it ends up, but it's not looking great. And number eight is a cheapo horror flick. It's Sinister 2. The original starred my friend Ethan Hawke, a good actor. He's made lots of good low-budget genre flicks that have made money. This one, he wasn't back for the sequel. Maybe they made a mistake. It cost $10 million to make. It's made $13 million on its opening weekend. It'll probably fall hard and fast, though. And number nine is another Chinese hit. It's Go Away, Mr. Tumor. It's a Chinese tearjerker. I'm guessing they changed the name if they bring that to the U.S. Anyway, it's a tearjerker, a sad tale of a very popular cartoonist who gets cancer. It's made another $13 million over the weekend. It's at $65 million and counting just in those a few territories.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger opening up Terminator against, Mr. Tumor. You know, you know the joke I can make here. It's a kindergarten cop joke. It's not a tumor.
I never saw Kindergarten Cop. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't laugh. I don't get the joke.
Okay. There's a running joke in Kindergarten Cop where some kid in the kindergarten keeps going, "It's a tumor." And
it's a tumor?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, whenever somebody gets
hilarious.
Hurt, he says, "It's a tumor." And Arnold Schwarzenegger is running around saying, "It's not a tumor."
Okay. Well, okay. He's probably happy to be reminded of better days at the box office. At number 10 is Minions. This is the Universal animated smash hit. It only cost $80 million to make. That's a rock bottom budget for an animated film. It made $12 million over the weekend. It's at $990 million worldwide. But here in North America, fascinatingly, it is now the third highest grossing film of all. No, I'm saying worldwide, rather. It is the third highest grossing animated film of all time. Now, I don't like to break movies down into the third highest romantic action, you know, But animated and live action, that's a pretty big divide, and animated films tend to be expensive. I think that's a reasonable thing to talk about as far as genres. That one big thing, documentaries, live action, and animated, those are reasonable distinctions to make to a degree. And Minions is the third highest grossing of all time. It passed The Lion King. It's now behind only Toy Story 3 and, of course, Frozen.
Wow.
Yeah. Right behind that is another big smash animated film. It had to be a smash. It cost $175 million to make, but it's Inside Out. It made $12 million. It's at $670 million worldwide, and it still has a ways to go overseas. Half of that is in North America.
Wow. That's, I mean, $350 million in North America. That's not bad.
That's more than Minions.
Yeah.
It's a big, big hit. So down towards the bottom, we have American Ultra. That's at number 17 worldwide. It made $6 million on its opening weekend, most of it in North America. This is the Jesse Eisenberg film. He has a great year. He's got a book out. He has a play out that he's wrote and starring in. He's got a couple movies, including a very well-reviewed one about David Foster Wallace. But this stoner action comedy has not launched successfully.
No.
It didn't cost a lot to make, of course. It only cost about $12 million. But, you know, maybe it'll be a cult hit down the road. Maybe people will discover it, but it didn't get great reviews. It's not doing well at the box office. It will soon be forgotten.
You know, it's weird. Some of the reviews I read, they all kind of agreed that this is a movie that will be found on home video, that it, you know, it will be overlooked in theaters, but that it, you know, it will find some fans because it's not a bad movie. It's just that, you know, it's one of those.
Well, I think it's just that it has good names in it. And so people, I'll check it out. I don't think it's to me, if you're going to say a movie will be discovered on DVD or streaming, it should be a movie that you think is really good that they missed out on. This sounds like a movie that's just not that good. So while some people will watch it, I don't think they'll watch it and say, oh, my God, you guys, you got to see this film. You know, it'll do better than its box office because of the names involved. And that happens a lot, doesn't it? If you get these stars, you know you're going to generate a little more business come DVD and streaming because people recognize the names and they remember the ads. So they go, oh, check that out.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why you can actually get a movie like American Ultra made because, you know, you put somebody in it like a Jesse Eisenberg. And now I'm completely blanking on the girl's
name. Kirsten Stewart.
Yeah. How could I forget that? I mean, I'm like, I could see her in my mind.
That's
I could
the
see
Czar
it.
Winner.
Yes.
Kirsten Stewart. Thank you very much. So just back off.
Yes. Well, you know, you put them in and you know, you have a like kind of a guaranteed
return. I don't think they're exactly there. Neither one of them is a guaranteed box office draw on their own.
No. I don't mean you're going to make, you know, $30-$50 million opening weekend, but you know that if you spend $10 million, you'll probably make it back.
You'll be okay.
Yeah.
You won't lose your shirt. But I'm going to put you on the spot here because there were two independent films that came out of Sundance. One won all the awards, and that's Me and Earl and The Dying Girl. And the other one is Dope, which is well reviewed, a sort of an urban modern spin on Risky Business.
Good
and by
movie. Good
I
movie.
Mean, it stars a black guy. So they came out. One, Me and Earl was platformed. Dope was done wide release. And you felt Me and Earl was smart. They were going the platform way. They were going to make more money than Dope. They were going to make it look stupid. They did the right thing where you felt Dope sort of blew it by going too wide too soon. So let's look at where
Wait a second. I never said Earl was doing the smart thing because if they were really being smart, they would have released that film in the fall or in the spring, but they decided
to
release
it in the summer. You felt it was a bad time?
Yeah, I understand why they did it in the heat. They were really trying to go after,
Fault in Our Stars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They were trying to repeat that, but without the big marketing budget behind it. And so that's not necessarily a recipe for success.
So they didn't do everything you would have liked. So you're going to say they already messed up a little bit. But how much did they cost? What did Earl cost and what did Dope cost?
Well, I think Earl, they picked it up for $12 million, right? And I think
we don't know what they spent on marketing.
Right. Let's call it $5 million. Even if they spent $7 million, they're still, look, the movie made $6.6 million in North America. So whatever they spent on marketing, it didn't matter because it didn't even make back its acquisition cost.
So Dope cost $7 million, but there was a guarantee that they would spend $20 million to market it.
I don't know where you saw that.
That was in the initial deal. That
really?
Was the Sundance deal. Everybody announced it. That was one reason they went with a lower bid because they said, we're not just going to dump it out there. We are going to spend significant money marketing this film because we think it's a commercial film. And that's partly why they went wide release. Now, whether they ended up spending $20 million, maybe, you know, they started with this amount and if it had kept going, they would have spent more and everybody agreed that they gave it a good, solid, wide release. I don't know. But that was the commitment that they made at Sundance and it was in all the stories about it. It ended up, of course, making $60 million at the box office, almost triple of what Earl made, but still not going to, you know, knock anybody's socks off. So Earl, maybe they spend about $17 million overall. And assuming that they're about $12 million in the red. Dope, however, they spent, you know, $27 million making and marketing at the most. And so they're $19 million. So they've perhaps lost more money on Dope at the moment. But have they raised Dope's visibility more for DVD and Blu-ray? Will it make a difference in streaming that it had that wide release? Do you think it's better positioned for the aftermarket than Earl? Or are they both sort of equal?
I think they're, I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, Dope will probably have a higher visibility, but these are both word of mouth movies. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the way
they should be discovered on streaming, unlike American Ultra, these are both good movies.
Yes, they're both good movies. Now, mind you, I've only seen, you know, snippets of Me, Earl and the Dying Girl. Still have not seen that movie. Dope is great. Worth seeing. A $20 million marketing commitment. I'm looking here. There's a lot of sources say around that figure. Whether they spent 20, that may have been contingent upon certain things. So
maybe they only spent 10 or 12.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
In which case they could be a lot closer to profitability. And of course there's overseas.
Yes, correct.
You know, somebody must have bought it for some territory.
Right, but they, you know, again, Open Road was acquiring that film, so they didn't necessarily get overseas.
So here in the U.S., the big news was, of course, the flop of American Ultra. And the new movie's open, but it's the dog days of August and moving into September. It's going to be a couple weeks before we have some big storyline. And certainly nothing is going to supplant Straight Outta Compton for a while. This is a smash hit about the rise of NWA. Now Dr. Dre is apologizing for things he did in his past when he was a young, stupid man and was violent towards women. And he's not the same person anymore. All sorts of stuff is coming up about this movie. But what's happening in Hollywood? What's happening? This movie's number one at the box office. What happened the next day, Sperling?
Oh, I'm a little confused. I don't know whether you're talking about the bean counters looking at their the money coming in from China and going, wait a second, the yuan went down in value,
or whether you're talking about Compton.
Whether you're talking about Regal Cinemas, which is
I'm talking about Straight Outta Compton.
Oh,
I'm talking about this movie. The next day, everybody pitched a rap film.
Oh well, yeah,
that's what happens in Hollywood.
That's not news.
Somebody walked in. No, of course, who said it was news? But the next day, I'm sure somebody went in and said, "We should make a movie about the Sugar Hill Gang."
That would be actually funny.
Absolutely. The Sugar Hill Records has a great story. It was founded by a husband and wife, Joe and Sylvia Robinson. And Sylvia was famous for Sylvia of Mickey and Sylvia. That was a duo that had a big hit with Love is Strange. They went in on it with Morris Levy, a Jew, because you can't have a record label without a Jew. No, that's terrible. I didn't say that. But Morris Levy has a very checkered past, and he's a very colorful guy, no doubt about it. They founded this label. Their very first record is Rapper's Delight, which turns out to be the first top 40 hit for hip hop. They helped pioneer the modern music video. Who directed one of their first videos? White Lines? Spike Lee.
That's right.
And by the way, Tyler James Williams of Dope, he will play Spike Lee in the film version of Sugar Hill Records.
Is this actually
and it
true?
It's called Rapper's Delight. I'm telling you, I'm packaging it right now.
Oh, okay.
Now, hell, we can let Spike Lee direct the film. Why not?
If Spike Lee does that, we want some credit.
Absolutely. And we don't need credit. It's such an obvious story. It's Hollywood. It's not original.
But
Sugar Hill Gang and Sugar Hill Records is a great story. They rose fast. They did great. And then it flamed out, of course, as small record labels often will. It ended up that the studio where they recorded burned down, I think it's some point later in Jersey. But it's a great rags to riches story. Little guy making big, helping break hip hop the early days. It's, you know, you got Grandmaster Flash, you got Mel, you got White Lines, you got Spike Lee. It's just a fun, fun story. And I'm sure it'll be moving. I'm sure Run DMC, they're probably out there pitching them as a movie. That's a great epic tale. They really are the modern, you know, wave of rappers all spring from Run DMC in a way. So I'm sure that has been pitched all over the place.
Well, you know, I think in part the pushback or the kind of, not pushback, but if there's any flack about Straight Outta Compton, it's more that I'm not saying that there is flack.
Where's their flack? It's made a lot of money. The only flack is that nobody rioted at the film. That's the only disappointment. What, nobody shot anybody yet? How did they do it?
Well, no, I mean, I think that there's some criticism, not flack, I guess. If there is any criticism, it's that...
Oh, about the content of the film.
Yeah, well, maybe this is a little bit of mythologizing here.
Well, duh.
Yeah. No.
It's their own story. Of course they are. Dr. Dre decided not to include where he, like, violently attacked women. Well, gee.
Yeah,
I can't imagine why, when I'm telling my story, I'm going to skip the part where I was throwing up a drunk.
Right.
You know, it's like, duh.
Wait a second. You're telling me that people with the names Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, and Ice Cube, that maybe their story...
No, don't say they. Don't say they.
What are you talking about?
What were you going to say?
That maybe their story, when they're telling their story, they're being some, you know, kind of embellishing a little bit. Heck, the guy's name is Ice Cube. Of course he's embellishing. They're characters to begin with.
Yeah, I don't expect somebody telling their own story to be warts and all necessarily. They did have it in an early draft of the film about Dr. Dre's violence toward women. It's well documented. He has acknowledged it. There is no recent history. It's not like Cosby where we have decades of it. Terrible thing to have done even once. Doesn't make me want to hang out with him. But he has apparently changed his ways. We have no, you know, stories of this from decades since. It wasn't an isolated incident. He did have a pattern of it, but apparently he has learned what an ass he was and has grown up and moved on. And, you know, that's the fact it could have been in the film. Absolutely. The movie would have been better. But, you know, you're telling your own story. I'm not surprised he didn't include it. Hardly a shock. But what is a shock to me is that Regal Cinemas is going to now make movies more secure. I want to ask you, Sperling, do you feel unsafe going to the movies? Is going to the movies a dangerous thing?
Yes, because, you know, I often fear, quite honestly, that I might fall asleep during the trailers because they're about 45 minutes long.
Or you feel you're getting ripped off because you buy popcorn and it's $7.50.
Yes, I'm not afraid that I might be ripped off. I know I'm being ripped off.
Right. There have been a few high visibility acts of violence in movie theaters over the past decade.
In North America.
Right. How many screens in North America? About 38,000, 40,000 screens?
Correct.
Which means there are probably three or four movie showings a day in each screen,
yes,
right?
Roughly.
So there's about 120,000 screenings a day in North America. And you multiply that by 10 days, you've got 1.2 million screenings. How many of them involved acts of violence? Like 0.0001%, right?
Yes.
So why suddenly are you going to act like movie theaters need to be weaponized? We need to have metal detectors. We need to have guard dogs and you have to have armed security. No.
You know,
movie theaters are not unsafe. Neither are fast food chains or grocery stores or any other place or churches where acts of violence have occurred. You cannot turn every location in the world into a fortress.
It's a few bad seeds that ruin it for everybody.
Well, don't call, you know, idiots or lunatics or people who are mentally unstable a few bad seeds. No, there's danger in the world, but it can happen anywhere, anytime, and unintelligent, stupid, knee-jerk reactions to it that don't even make you safer, but in fact just make you inconvenience you and pretend to make you safer is what I really hate. I really hate it when they do stuff that doesn't make you safer, but just inconveniences you, and they pretend they're doing it for you. They used to do that at ballparks. They wouldn't let you bring in a laptop. What the hell? You know what? Because, well, we don't want to have to check it. And it's like laptops are not a source of danger. Like people would go for work. You'd have to check your laptop across the street before you could go to a Yankee game.
Yeah, now, they did that at Dodger Stadium after 2001 for like, I think, the rest of the season. And then they were like, you know what? This is ridiculous. Forget it. Take
Yankees
your laptop.
Did it for a decade.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So what happened at Regal Cinemas? What have they done?
They've decided that they're going to start checking, I guess they're checking bags, which... You know, in a way, you kind of have to wonder if people will turn around and say, you know, gee, who brings bags to movie theaters? It's mostly purses.
Well, you do in cities, and you're right, in the suburbs, it's just the woman.
Right. So, women
can kill, just like men. They have the right to be lunatics.
Yes, that's true. Please.
But what did Adam Levine say? This is what I can't handle. He's a guy with a cybersecurity firm, and he told The Wrap, which is a good website, he said, "This shouldn't be seen as a Second Amendment issue." This is what he said. It's not political. He said, quote, "It's literally a matter of life and death. And those involved need to accept their responsibility and work for a collaborative and comprehensive solution." What is this? What is the problem that he's solving here? The fact that there are idiots in the world, lunatics? And does searching your bag solve it?
No, and let me tell you something. Part of the problem here is that Regal now has this the question becomes one of liability. When something like this happens,
you do not decrease your liability by looking in a purse.
I completely agree.
There is not an insurance company in the world that would say, oh, well, you open their purses. I guess the theater's safer, so now we can't sue you.
Right.
That doesn't happen.
They're still going to sue whether you had somebody there looking in a purse or not.
And a half-assed joke of a thing that doesn't solve the problem. This is what drives me crazy. People usually prepare for the last war, or they prepare for the last mistake. They say, oh, well, we got to build this wall so that the waves don't, but they forget there can also be wind and a hurricane. You know, they prepare for the last thing that went wrong rather than the next thing, because it's hard to predict the next thing. I get that. But they prepare for the last problem. But in this case, they're not even preparing for the last problem. What happened to train wreck? A guy left his weapon outside the fire exit. What happened to Dark Knight Rises? The guy left his stuff in his car. He sat in the movie theater. He left at the fire exit, propped the door open, went to his car, got all his stuff, and then came back in. What happened at Mad Max Fury Road? That was in Nashville. This nut job stormed in the theater with all his weapons exposed. In none of those cases would checking somebody's bag prevent the problem. None of them. Yeah, so they're not even looking at what just happened and saying, well, what can we do to make sure that doesn't happen again? And God forbid you say, maybe the reason there's so many killings in the U.S. is because we have more guns than anybody else in the world. But you can't say that, because then you're politicizing it. I mean, one guy was paranoid schizophrenic. The mother feared him. Another one was hospitalized by court order.
Look, you don't have to. I mean, look, I think we're spending more time on this story than the U.S. media did, because I think a lot of people
look. Well, Regal Cinemas has just changed their policy around the country. How big are they? They're the biggest chain in North America, right?
Yeah, I mean,
right?
They are.
So 7,324 screens across the country. They're the biggest theater chain. And now when you go there, they're going to waste time and energy opening your bag. And they're not, you know what? I keep soda and food in my bag. I know just to leave my book on top of it. I open the bag, they glance in, and they don't see my soda or whatever I'm bringing in, because I can't be bothered to pay $8 for water. Whatever they see, they barely look at it, and they don't pat you down. I got a gun in my, under my pant belt and my back of my back. I've got a gun in my bag, which they won't glance. They don't even look, and they just glance. What's the point? It's just a joke.
Well, I think there was a board meeting, and they said, how can we annoy Michael Giltz when he comes to our cinemas?
Well, everyone should be annoyed. I'm happy to make changes in what you do if it actually improves security and addresses a reasonable problem.
I think, quite honestly, that the reason this didn't get a lot of attention is I think the media looked at this and went, well, that'll be a short-lived campaign.
Because really? You think Regal will stop checking bags in a few weeks?
Yeah, I think that people will just be so annoyed. Maybe not, but we'll see. I can't imagine. I mean, first of all, it's not cost-effective to do this, okay? So it's going to cost them money, number one.
Well, they're not going to have trained. Are they going to have new trained people who know how to? And it doesn't matter if they're not patting you down and having you go through a metal detector and looking at, then it's not a security measure. It's a joke.
Yeah.
It's just a cosmetic PR move, and they should be pilloried for doing it.
Well, you just did.
All right.
Now,
they're taking a beating from Michael. What's happening to the rest of media? They seem to be taking a beating from everyone.
Yes, that's true, actually. I guess what we're talking about here is television and the media companies. Walt Disney Company, for instance, and Cablevision and Comcast, all of them.
Universal.
They kind of came out and said, you know, some of our movies are doing okay. So let's talk about that for a second. And by the way, let's continue talking about that while we quickly tell you about how television is tanking. And it's not tanking in terms of nobody's watching it. It's not tanking in terms of, the money that it's earning. It's that the way we watch television is changing. And whenever that happens, there's fear, uncertainty, doubt that the existing business models in place will be enough or will be sustained.
All right. So we're looking at these media companies and what's been happening. There's a number of different stories. We'll just look at a few of them really briefly. But basically, we're looking at the stock market, where they're taking a pounding.
Yes.
We're looking at the upfront sales, which is where TV networks sell most of their commercial time for the new fall season and into the spring, and how well they did there. We're looking at the coverage of television and cord cutting and how realistic or accurate it is. We're looking at other new revenue streams that they're having and how set-top boxes are doing and the vast, overwhelming number of TV shows that are being created. Clearly, we're at a new peak, so that's not going to last. So they've got all these storylines that are sort of converging to say, oh my God, everything's changing. And people panicked, right? A few weeks ago, the media stocks really took a big hit, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, you basically had the Amazons of the world down 20%, the Netflixes of the world down.
Now you're confusing me. Now we were talking about traditional media companies. That
okay,
were
so you want to talk about just
because they are facing cord cutting, and what Wall Street said is, Time Warner, Disney, Universal, all these big media companies, they lost $50 billion in value in 2 days, just a few weeks ago.
Right.
Because suddenly everybody said, cord cutting's happening. Their ad sales at the upfronts weren't that big, and they all took a hit.
Well, but wait a second. Aren't they up for the year? Like, if you look at them, like, January 1st, and then
some
today,
of them are at 52-week lows, but that's just because of where we are at today. So okay, these traditional media companies took a hit a few weeks ago, but then so did Netflix.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
I'm like, why would Netflix, if you're saying traditional media is dead and all these new companies are going to beat your ass, why would the new company take a hit? Why would Netflix suffer? Shouldn't they be going to record heights?
I would assume so, yeah.
Right. And of course, today, media stocks are taking a hit again, but that's because the market overall has been on a 6-year bull run, right?
Yeah.
I mean, stocks are at a they've been going up and up and up for 6 years. So now we have a correction that's affecting the entire market, and already it slowed down today. But yesterday and today, we're getting close to a correction, which means a 10% fall in stock or more, which is natural. After you've been going up for 6 years, you're supposed to have a correction. That's how life works. It doesn't go up forever and ever. So the media stocks today are taking a hit, but that's just more about being part of the stock market in general.
Yeah, I mean, they're calling it the media meltdown.
Well, what's happened at the upfronts? What is the upfronts?
The upfronts is where they basically show, if they're not showing, either clips or entire episodes of these shows and announce their fall schedule. All these networks are showing their new shows or existing shows for the new season and saying, here's our schedule, please buy advertising. And they sell a good chunk, if not a majority, of their advertising during the upfront. So all these networks kind of in May and June, they walk out, they know exactly how much their advertising is going to make because they've already sold it.
Yeah, they usually sell about 80%. Those are like the 30-second or 1-minute slots available between shows and during shows on prime time. And they sell daytime, too. Do they sell daytime, too? And upfront is for everything, or is it just for the fall primetime channels?
I think it's mostly primetime, but they do sell everything.
They do sell everything. And, of course, we're not talking just about the big 4 or 5. How do you count the CW? We're also talking about cable. Like, TBS will step in with their portfolio of cable channels, and they will sell ads to their primetime. So it's not just the big networks, but those are the guys you focus on. And this year, they sold about 80% of their inventory. And it seems like every year that's a little lower than usual, perhaps. But it seems like if they've got a really strong lineup, they like to hold back some ads because they know they can get more. And if they have a really weak lineup, they have to hold some back because they only got less. So it always seems they end up with about 80% sold and another 20% available as scatter. That is, you show up in April and you need to buy an ad next week. They've got ads available on the scatter market.
Right. Now, I guess in part what they're seeing a little bit is that brands are shifting their TV ad dollars, knowing that there's some what's called linear television, linear being first show X is on, then show Y is on, then show Z is on, so that it's programmed. And
as Thursday night on NBC used to be Cosby Show, Family Ties, Cheers, maybe Night Court, depends, it changed a lot, or Taxi, and then Hill Street Blues or LA Law. That was a classic Thursday night lineup.
Linear television. Now, of course, all the brands know that, gee, just because it's on at 9 p.m. doesn't mean anybody's going to be watching it at 9 p.m. They're beginning to shift ad dollars to Hulu and these on-demand services. Mm-hmm. So the networks themselves, the linear channels and networks, they're seeing their ad, the pie that they used to just split up between themselves, now they have to split up with others.
Right. So it was not a great upfront.
Now,
networks were up, some... Mm-hmm.
What they're also seeing, and this is what investors are seeing, and this, by the way, is why you're seeing this quote-unquote panic or this meltdown in media companies. What they're beginning to see is, for the past, these past, let's call it decade or so, you've seen that these multi-channel video subscribers, so Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and I would imagine in Europe it's Sky TV and others, you know, there was a low single-digit increase in subscriber growth. It wasn't as huge as it was in the 80s and early 90s, but it was like, 2, 3, 4% subscriber growth. Now what you're seeing...
It's a mature market.
It's flat or it's down. So of course everybody says,
because there are no more people left.
Yes, correct.
You can't go up forever. You got 95 million homes. How many do you expect?
Yeah, it gets to a point where the only way you can increase revenue is to increase price.
Right. So that's part of the changing pattern. But the first, canary in the coal mine is the upfront sales. You know, this is the major networks. They show up, all the advertisers show up, and they sell a bunch of their ads for the next season. And guess what? It wasn't a great upfront. But you know what? If you look at it, the networks that have a really good lineup, they did well. And the networks that had sort of a weak last season or don't have a lot of stuff going on, they didn't do as well. It's not exactly, you know, NBC had a $6 billion upfront. They were up 2%. They're getting more per viewer. Fox was down because their only hit is Empire, and they've got a lot of weak stuff on their schedule. ABC was up 6% from last year. CBS is very strong, but it's so strong it's not going to go up a lot because it's been doing great for years. And the CW had a good year. They're up 4% in what they're getting per eyeball. That's called CPM or cost per thousand. So, you know, they're making more per viewer, and they jumped up 12 or 15% in volume thanks to, you know, two or three or four big hits after years of being sort of, you know, flatlining at 400 million. They're now up to about 450 million. So it wasn't a great upfront, but it's hardly a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think that if you were to ask any of the TV executives whether there is a decline in ad revenue, they'd say, no, it's still fine. Yeah, okay, so maybe it's flattening out, and brands and media buyers are spending their money across different platforms. You know, I think that's probably true. But there are ways to recapture that revenue, especially if you happen to own Hulu.
Right, exactly. If the money is migrating, but guess what? It's like you're at a Walmart and you go to the food section, and then you go to the light bulb section. Well, it's the same company. So if you're buying your TV and you're buying a cable bundle from a Time Warner Cable, and then you leave your cable bundle and you pay Time Warner for your HBO, it's still the same company.
Yeah, I mean, do I think cord cutting is taking place? Sure, I think it's taking place. Do I think it's taking place at the alarming rate that every... Look, a 1% decline is not a huge... I mean, come on.
So let's look at the media coverage of cord cutting. What's happening? We're just getting numbers on the second quarter. And traditionally, the second quarter is weak, and you often lose subscribers. I don't know why, but in the second quarter, people tend to roll back. They're not signing up, and people are leaving. There's always churn. And in the second quarter, which is traditionally weak, this year, again, there was churn, right?
Okay.
And so they said, it's the end of the world. But what actually happened in the second quarter? What happened was that cable was fine and satellite took the real hit. People are not sticking with DirecTV and Dish. I don't know why they're leaving satellite as compared to compared to cable, but they are. That was where the big decline was. Cable actually had its best quarter in 7 years in the second quarter. You know, for the amount of losses that they had, it was their best year in ages.
Yeah,
so they had a great quarter. So people are not fleeing cable. And when you think about cord cutting, you're traditionally thinking of cable, but people don't care where they get it from. They're not paying for a satellite dish or a cable or for what, you know, they are paying for content.
Well, but you're also looking at investors who are seeing the fact that these media companies, and by media companies, I'm not talking about the service providers, the MSOs, the multi-channel service providers, like, say, Time Warner Cable. I'm talking about Walt Disney Company. I'm talking about, the Discovery Network. And they're seeing all these set-top boxes go out there and all of these media companies starting to allow their content to be sold a la carte. And they're saying, well, gee, you know what? Maybe, you know, what is it? Apple and Roku are now in like 20 million homes. Although, can I just say something for just a second as a bit of an aside? So yesterday I rented something on Amazon, okay? So, you know, Amazon Instant Video, which I used to be able to watch on my TiVo. However, my TiVo is a Series 3, so it's an older version, but it's still good, it's still fine. TiVo has removed the ability to watch that kind of content on, from Amazon across the TiVo. So they basically removed functionality from and the ability to watch video on demand.
Wow. Maybe it's time to leave TiVo.
I said, you know what? I would say, by the way, they did this in March, so I should have known that on April 15th that was going to happen. But you know what? I think the reason it wasn't such a big news is nobody's on TiVo anymore, so it doesn't matter.
That's right. Well, I don't know. Are they cord cutting? There was a big headline about Mexico, and it says, Mexicans are cord cutting, quietly. And the actual story said, in Mexico, OTT, over-the-top services, people buying that, people paying for it, has increased 50%.
Okay.
Great. All right. That's growing a lot. Traditional pay TV, that also increased. It increased by 15%.
So
that's not cord. How is that cord cutting?
Well,
so they said OTT is doing great, but so is pay cable.
Maybe what they're afraid of is, gee, right now OTT is kind of supplemental. Okay. It's like kind of on top of what they have.
You've got your cable and you've got your Netflix.
Right. And what they're doing is doing exactly, you know, not fighting the last war, as you say, Michael. They're actually, the investors are looking and going, wait a second. If OTT is growing 50%, you know what's going to wind up happening in 5 years is that everybody's going to start dropping something, and it ain't going to be the OTT. It's going to be the traditional cable subscription. That's what their fear is.
That means the one person that's in trouble is the sole person whose job is cable provider, right? If that's your only business, you're in trouble. Because yes, if you cut your cable company and you get rid of your bundling, you're still going to need broadband.
Right. Why do you think there was this big war over net neutrality? Because everybody sees it going this way. So they are actually thinking ahead, and they are actually trying to plan for where the revenue will come from in the future. And people like Comcast and Time Warner Cable and all of the MSOs, they don't want to be dumb pipes. And that's pretty much what they've been turned into.
Right, but that doesn't affect the other media companies. If you're Time Warner Cable and your only business is that, yes, I had a $120 cable bill, and now I'm paying you $50 just for broadband because I'm going to need broadband.
Right.
So, yes, they've lost out on that. But all the other media companies like Time Warner, which is a different business, or Disney, okay, you get rid of your cable bundle. Now you're going to pay for your ESPN over the top. You're going to pay for your Disney over the top. You're going to pay for your, you know, this, that, and the other thing over the top. And that's, they're going to, it's the same people. They're going to get your money one way or another. You're not going to stop watching ESPN. When you look at what people are watching, they're watching as much TV as ever. They are not turning away from TV. They're just getting it in a different way. And you want to be part of that new universe. But to publish the people with content makes no sense to me. To publish the new media companies like Netflix, not that they may not be overvalued compared to their earnings and all that, but why you would punish them in a panic over cord cutting, they're Netflix.
I thought you were saying publish. Okay, so you're saying punish. You know, I think part of what you're seeing here is investors looking at how these companies are making money, realizing that a lot of that is in retransmission consent fees that people pay whether they want to or not. Whether you want to pay for ESPN or not, you're paying for it if you're a cable subscriber because it's on basic cable and you're paying the $5 per month for that channel no matter what. And they're seeing that and they're saying, well, gee, if people are going to cut their cords and pay for their content in other ways, fine. You know, maybe the networks won't have anything to worry about, except for the fact that right now the networks are making money on content that nobody's watching and it's kind of subsidizing them. We're all subsidizing ESPN, whether we watch it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can understand that they're kind of saying, how will all of these OTT fees make up for the retransmission fees, which will decline?
Well, that's why you should check out an interview with John Landgraf of FX. He's the head of FX, and he has a good interview where he talks about it's a changing world, absolutely, and looks at all the different ways and how the numbers are changing here, there, and everywhere, and how you got to prepare for the future. But, you know, he feels good because he's got a great portfolio of TV shows like The Americans and Louie. And what else has he got? Fargo. So, you know, he's got a lot of good stuff on his channel and he feels like he's going to be in a good place come down the road. And yeah, he agrees. Cable bundling is fraying. Absolutely. So is the idea of a network. And what's happening is that people are watching TV in a new way. But he says, you know, like 10 years ago, 50% of the revenue his company made, meaning his division FX, was 50% came from ad dollars. Their revenue, 50% of it came from ad dollars. Today, their ad revenue is only 35% of what they make.
Okay.
So it's dropping. Content ownership 10 years ago was nothing. They made no money off owning their own content. Now, thanks to selling off, you know, reruns of The Americans and Fargo to FX, to Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime and other places, now it's up to 12%. So instead of 50%, it's 47% of their revenue is coming from ad dollar and content ownership. You know, they've dropped a little bit, but they're making money in new ways. 95% of their audience today are people who watch FX on a cable channel. He says maybe 10 years from now, it'll be 50%. And you got to adjust, but they're still going to be watching the shows. They're still going to be making money just in new ways.
I mean, ultimately, let's face it, over the last, let's say, 2 weeks, this whole quote unquote media meltdown, it's been a big news story. It's been probably the biggest news story in media, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been an overreaction. I think you give too much credit to investors. They're like, oh, cord cutting. They just panic. They panic and they saw. You know what happened? Almost all media companies are down today. You know what one media company is not down? DreamWorks Animation. Good for them. I don't know why, but for some reason they've decided DreamWorks Animation will survive and flourish in the new world of cord cutting. How that makes any sense, why they would be the one to be spared, I don't know. But God, maybe it's because Dino Trucks just debuted somewhere, you know, that I think went on Amazon.
I have no idea.
Dino Trucks has just debuted like a day or two ago. Maybe the ratings were through the roof. It makes no sense why DreamWorks, of all the media companies in the world, the one company that's been kicked in the face for the last year or so, that is the one company people were not selling off.
Well, so then you're saying it's kind of not a big deal.
I think it's a big deal. Good for them. They're happy. But yes, it is time for Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Did I mention One Direction broke up?
You did, which we now know is a big deal.
Yes.
Or something like that. Now, Mars needs women. And so does the film industry. The European film industry has made it official by releasing a declaration that women should be represented more fully both in front of and behind the camera. Women, after all, represent a majority of the population, so at the very least, they should represent 50% of directors and writers and studio executives and actors and actresses, since much of the European film industry is funded in part or in whole by public financing. This call to action might indeed have some teeth. Of course, they made the same pledge in 2008, but this time they promise it's different. Women make up less than 20% of directors and producers of films made in Europe. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
What?
If they had actually instituted something or shown some progress or done anything to make you believe that it was more than just, oh, that would be a good idea. You know, call me when you've done something.
Okay.
You know, come on. 7 years ago, they did the same damn thing.
Music festivals are taking up an increasing chunk of tune-loving customers' attention and spending on live entertainment. Digital streaming is fine, but nothing beats seeing a great act in the flesh. However, when it comes to the numerous headliners that sell a fest, you can't always count on those names. Many established festivals sell out even before announcing their acts. I already have tickets to Coachella next year, and the acts haven't been announced.
And sadly for you, I'm going to be playing in the second stage. So really, probably not money well spent.
Hey, you know, I don't think you're allowed to say that before.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. Still, the growing FYF festival happened here in Los Angeles over the weekend. It scored a huge coup and ticket sales when it booked Frank Ocean, the openly gay rapper who doesn't really tour a lot. But tickets say all acts are subject to change, and Ocean did just that. So on the back of the tickets, it says, you know, the lineup can change. And Frank Ocean dropped out 2 days before the event. Kanye West filled the gap with a well-reviewed set, and the fest also featured Morrissey and Block Party and D'Angelo and a bunch of others. Ocean had no comment and is reportedly still finishing up his new album, Boys Don't Cry, the much-anticipated follow-up to his acclaimed Channel Orange. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? The guy, you know, backed out of a festival. He didn't do it well. You know,
no.
You shouldn't drop out in the last minute unless you're suddenly sick, and there's no comment as to why. You know, he's still working on his album. Well, you should have either decided months ago or you should go to the festival and perform. So it was not cool, but I love the coverage. Spin Magazine says, hey, Frank Ocean owes us nothing, but how dare he? It's like, well, make up your mind. You know, he's working on a new album, but yeah, you shouldn't commit to a festival and then back out. He doesn't do a lot, so it's not like he has a big pattern of this, but they're angry because he sort of teased a new album would come out in July, and then he didn't even tease that it wasn't coming out in July. He said nothing. So they're like, no, this is not how you do it. You know, if you're going to drop an album on us, you can't pretend it's going to happen and then say nothing. You got to give us another hint that it's going to take longer.
Right.
So say nothing, I guess, is the rule.
Well, and I just think that the 2 days beforehand, it's one thing.
Well, that's bad if you're sick or something. Yeah, it's totally unprofessional. No question about it. I don't mean to downplay unprofessionalism because that's exactly what it is. And good for good old Kanye to come through. Have you ever been to FYF?
I have not, no, because usually I'm at Coachella and a lot of the same acts are at FYF. It's been a little bit more punk than...
It sounds like it's changed now.
Yeah, and quite honestly, it's been in a smaller space. They just moved over to the LA Coliseum and Sports mm-hmm. Arena, and last year was kind of a mess as far as...
It was a cluster something or other, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was like, definitely not going to go this year. Have no desire to go. And I think that they were hurting for ticket sales because all of a sudden SiriusXM sent me an email saying, hey, you know, we can, you know, subscribers, free tickets. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah,
what
they had a little weak ticket sales, no question about that. And that's why they made clear when he backed out that it was his choice. It wasn't like they were unhappy with ticket sales and wanted someone else. He chose to back out at the last minute.
Right.
Oh, well.
Well, Frank Ocean might not be around, but Hollywood is back, baby. And by Hollywood, I mean L.A. And by back, I mean movie and TV production, which never went away, but is now stabilized at a new normal. The best sign of that, the return of 20th Century Props, was announced last week. The famed props company shocked Hollywood when closing shop abruptly in 2009. Now, owner Harvey Schwartz has reopened his company at a new location in Van Nuys. The LA Times cited new tax breaks that allow LA and the rest of California to compete better and lure back production from foreign lands with strange names like, I hope I'm not pronouncing this, you know, I hope I'm pronouncing it properly and not mispronouncing it, South Coralina and
Albuquerque.
Ah, thank you. Well, is the return of 20th Century Props a big deal or a big whoop?
A big whoop.
What?
Well, why did they shut down? What's the point of storing your stuff in a warehouse? Then you're making zero money. Was it so expensive to run your shop that you were losing money week to week?
Yes,
I don't get it. Why were they having 7 years of no profit?
Well, you know, 20th Century Props had facilities all over Los Angeles and in some seriously kind of high rent areas because they weren't high rent when he first.
Why would you be in a high rent area when you have props? Well, I would think you'd be in a warehouse out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, again, you want to be where the studios are. So one of the studios.
It's props.
Yeah. Well, one of the studios was one of the warehouses, a whole block of warehouses, in fact, was right across the street from Paramount Pictures or right down the street from Paramount, which at the time when they opened was probably a low rent district and over time became a high rent district.
So now, what they've done is they've relocated themselves in a cheaper area.
And they've
downsized. So that their overall costs will be cheaper. Is Van Nuys, are they in the middle of like a big, do you know where they are?
Yes.
Oh, is it like,
it's in Van Nuys.
Does it look like an expensive area or does it look like it's probably cheap or whatever?
Well, you did say Van Nuys, right?
I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, it means it's definitely not, you know, across the street from Paramount.
So they were locked into contracts and rentals of spaces that were prohibitively expensive. I don't know why it took them 7 years, but I'm glad they're back.
Yeah, and they started closing down slowly, like they'd close one warehouse, then another warehouse, and then all of a sudden, the whole business was, yeah. And it did shock people at the time, because it is, kind of a well-known prop house in the business.
And we looked at the figures, and they really had bottomed out for a little while there, and now it looks like they're not back at peak level, but production in Los Angeles, after years of being chipped away at by different cities and states and countries, is at a good, healthy level again.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely stabilized.
And how is Broadway doing? They're doing great.
That's right. In fact, the name brand entertainer Cirque du Soleil are coming to Broadway. The troupe is preparing a new show called Paramore. It's got a Hollywood theme and uses much of the same creative team that delivered Iris, a show that opened in LA and closed within 2 years and probably at a loss. I remember that show opening and then...
Did you see it? No.
No. Unlike most Cirque shows, Paramore will be story-driven, not stunt-driven. It's about a young poet forced to choose between love and art.
A poet? If it's a Hollywood theme, shouldn't it be like a young director, young actor? Anyway.
Yeah, it should be basically Moulin Rouge. This is the second show on Broadway Cirque is involved in. They're also partnering on The Wiz. That show will somehow combine the classic musical with Cirque acrobatics. And it comes to Broadway after debuting live on NBC this December 3rd. Actually, that's not a bad idea. But Paramore gets there first, opening in June of 2016 at the cavernous Lyric, where On the Town and, yes, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, have played. Big deal or big whoop?
That's the only reason to do this story. it is a total big whoop for two reasons. First of all, the one thing Cirque does poorly is story.
Yeah, I know.
That is the last thing they should be. Every time they try to do a story, you cringe and go, oh, shut up and just do acrobatics because this is not your wheelhouse. And they announced they're going to Broadway. They're going to do a Broadway-style show with actors and a story. And they announced the entire creative team except for whoever's writing the actual damn play. They don't even have a writer. So, like, that's the last thing on their mind. So, clearly, they have not... prepare. It's June. It's opening in June, and they don't have a writer yet.
So what you're saying is, stop with all the talking and singing, and turn yourself into a human pretzel.
Well, if they wanted to seriously tackle and create an actual story, It should begin with the story. And I would suggest strongly not making up some malarkey. A young poet, buy something and turn it into a story and hire an actual writer who's written musicals to write a script and then start from there. But obviously, they've got the cart before the house. They're doing a show. Hey, we got to get a story too, right? That's what this is all about, right? It's just, it shows a complete lack of priority. Well, and I don't take them seriously because they haven't done their serious work to do it right.
Well, now let me ask you this. Hamilton, of course, first full week, it's going gangbusters. But Hedwig and the monster. Angry Inch, okay? Hedwig and the Angry Inch, this was Neil Patrick Harris's, you know, he played the part that John Cameron Mitchell made famous. Now you have Taye Diggs in the role. And I guess it's grossing $400,000, playing to 75% capacity. The producers, who made their money back already, so they made their money back in 15 weeks, they're now going to shut down after 506 regular performances. Were you surprised?
No, not at all. It was amazing it lasted this long. They were bringing in people, you know, to do 6-week, 2-month, 3-month, 4-month runs. And that's hard to do. You got to have a new person. Taye Diggs killed Hedwig. You know, he did not have a great run. He was not getting great buzz from the audience. He didn't triumph in the part. And a lot of other people had done well, like Darren Criss and Michael C. Hall. And of course, Neil Patrick Harris and the original John Cameron Mitchell came in. It's run like an amazing amount of time, a year and a half, for this show to run 500 performances is pretty crazy. So it's a success. It's made money. It's been great. It's proven that Hedwig, just as they did in the original run, but for now, there's no question that it's a part and a role in a show that should have a future life. It's not dependent on John Cameron Mitchell. So it's happy news all around.
The force is strong with this Japanese airline. Yes, ANA, a Japanese-based airliner, is partnering with Lucasfilm for some Star Wars marketing tie-ins. Their planes will be branded with visuals that feature the new droid BB-8, as well as the lovable R2-D2, who of course famously handles in-flight repairs with a few handy attachments and some well-placed beeps.
Beep, beep.
Although, let me tell you something. If I recall correctly, if you had R2-D2 on your, like, aircraft, you were being shot at and something bad was going to happen. So I wouldn't want him on my plane. Big deal or big whoop?
It's hard to think of something that's more of a big whoop.
Okay, because, you know, what I want to know is, who exactly are they marketing to? Are they marketing to the birds at 30,000 feet? How am I supposed to see this ad?
Keep going.
Come on, no? Okay.
No.
Spotify freaked out a boisterous portion of the online community, not to mention its customers, with a new privacy policy. This happened last week. In short, you have none. No privacy. Spotify said it could access your info, your photos, location, voice control, and contacts. Wired and Forbes and many others decried it as quote-unquote eerie and quote-unquote creepy. Spotify's Daniel Ek responded with, "Trust us!" And I feel like I should do this in a Swedish accent, but won't. He says, "Let me be crystal clear here. If you don't want to share this kind of information, you don't have to," he wrote in a post. "We will ask for your express permission before accessing any of this data. And we will only use it for specific purposes that will allow you to customize your Spotify experience." Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, you're a market leader. You don't want to give anyone an intro into your market and your audience by saying, doing something stupid or wrong and messing with the millions of people that already use you. Why would your music site need to have access to your contacts or your photos? It's like, whatever you're planning to do with them, I'm not interested. Stay out of my phone.
It's a whole like, oh, your friend is listening to such and such.
Yeah. And I hate it when I don't let anybody ever access my contacts.
You know,
ever for anything.
Whenever I launch Spotify, the thing that takes the longest to load is all of that social stuff. Everything else is loaded. And then, my computer freezes while it's like, oh, let me go get the social stuff.
Yeah, it's stupid. You know, why annoy people? And why would they think it wouldn't annoy you? Oh, well, we just want to read your contacts. What's wrong with that?
Well, this next story is more of a Netflix meet Dish Flix. Amazon and Netflix are both eager to enter the Indian market. But before they can, India has a new VOD service. It's called Dish Flix. Yes, Dish TV.
We're not dead yet.
Well, no. This is not Dish TV. Okay?
Oh, it's not. It's not.
You know, Dish Flix is already being kind of chided for, it sounds a lot like Netflix. And so Dish TV, not the Dish Network. Yeah.
Oh, it's not the same company.
No, it's not the same company.
I thought it was an Indian division of Dish Network.
It's
okay.
Not. They are the proclaimed largest direct to home entertainment company in Asia. They say that themselves.
Then it must be true.
Yeah, well, exactly. So Dish TV beat all those other companies, Amazon and Netflix, to the punch and is offering a satellite delivered service direct to people's homes. They say it's faster than broadband in India in most cases and costs $3 a month with the purchase of a $93 box. Another competitor is Eros International, which has a film library of over 3,000 titles.
All of them pulled from Skinemax.
No.
I mean, they're called Eros International.
No.
It sounds like softcore, doesn't it?
It does, but it's not. Just so happens that they're called that. They have 26 million subscribers, though, and that's a lot. Although maybe not when you have 1.4 billion people in your country. Yeah. And they are launching an original programming initiative as well, although they haven't actually announced any titles. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
It's a big whoop, right?
Well, it's a wait and see whoop.
So they're the largest self-proclaimed direct-to-home entertainment company in Asia, but they've just launched in India? So they're in China? They're in Korea? Where are they?
Well, no. They're in India. Okay.
So they're in India, but they've just launched.
Right, but Asia, you know, includes India.
Right. So I'm saying, are they big in Korea? Are they big in...
No.
Are they big? How can they be the biggest?
Well, they have 20... You know, I don't know, to be honest.
No. Eros is 26 million people.
Right.
So Dish TV says they're the biggest. In what countries are they big?
India.
No, they just launched. You just said they've launched.
Dish TV.
That's the whole story.
Dish TV just launched.
So what's the difference between Dish Flix and Dish TV?
Dish TV in India is like a... You know, like a service provider.
Last week, when there was no such thing as Dish Flix and I wanted Dish TV, what would I get? Would it be cable?
Yeah, pretty much.
Via satellite?
Yes.
Yeah. So they're making available, but it's a box, so I don't get the difference. Don't they still have a satellite dish outside?
I guess what they're saying is we will now have, video on demand, a subscription video on demand.
I don't think we understand what's going on there. So, because I don't know of any cable channel that doesn't provide VOD. I mean, if you have Time Warner Cable, you got VOD, right?
Yes.
Is this
subscription video on demand?
Anybody in India who knows the difference between Dish TV and Dish Flix, what do they do, Sperling?
Dish TV.
Contact us at.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I see what you're doing. You're setting me up there with a softball, and I'm trying to figure this story out. Okay. Yeah, you could contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on the interwebs, much like...
And maybe we should have used those to figure out what was going on before we ran the story.
Right. But, you know, heck, I know a lot of online media outlets that don't do that, like BuzzFeed.
Oh, we're done with Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Yes, we're done with Big Deal, Big Whoop. In fact, we're moving on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. NBC Universal is spending some money. They're investing in BuzzFeed, $200 million. And, Michael, I know...
And that compares to just a few years ago where they raised $50 million from a group of investors, right?
Right.
So this is a big... This is meaning they're valuing this company at a lot of money. I don't know what chunk of BuzzFeed they got for $200 million. Do we know? But that's a good amount of money. And I would imagine that when a big company targets you and picks you up and invests in you, that means you're probably pretty much dead, right?
Well, I don't know about that.
Your fun day has passed because now you're just a big part of a big multimedia conglomerate. And, you know, you're not cool anymore when the big boys pay attention to you.
Well, I think what's happening here, first of all, everybody was paying attention to BuzzFeed because their traffic is off the charts. Okay. But,
and it's four clicks and you're gone in 3 seconds.
Yeah. I was just going to say, arguably we could counter that with their traffic is off the charts. Maybe not because we meant to land there, but that's another story entirely. I think really, if you were to take a step back and look at the story, what you're seeing is NBC Universal, pardon, one of these media companies we were talking about, Michael, going, gee, we need to attract a certain demographic, people in their 20s and their 30s, maybe the 40s.
Well, they can't think BuzzFeed is going to feed people to watch The Blacklist on NBC. And they're not thinking that this website is going to be a portal to bring people to watch more NBC. Don't they just think it's a good business on its own?
I think they do. What I loved was Scott Collins, who's been a guest here on the show. he's over at the LA Times. He had a listicle, 5 awesome, totally incredible reasons NBC is investing in BuzzFeed, which it's kind of a play on the type of headlines you get on BuzzFeed.
Yeah, the problem is the last time somebody did that and made fun of them with 5 totally cool things that BuzzFeed should do, BuzzFeed just then went ahead and did them all. They did. It's pretty good. I hate BuzzFeed. This is a site I never go to. It's just a moronic clickbait. It's like the Daily Mail website, and everybody's copying the Daily Mail. And before I throw stones at others, believe me, I'm on Huffington Post, and I'm not happy with the direct. It's not my site. I don't direct it. I'm not involved with them. But my content is on there, and I don't like what they're becoming. You get away from the front, but you get a bunch of stupid junk there as well. So it's plaguing all of these because they've all seen the Daily Mail, which is like the number one media website in the world, right?
The Daily Mail? Are you serious?
The Daily Mail has crazy worldwide traffic. And that's why everybody is copying them and dumbing down their websites. You see it on the Daily News. You see it on Huffington Post. BuzzFeed was born stupid. You know, and this is a website plagued by plagiarism. It's saying Pew Research identified BuzzFeed as one of the least reliable and trusted sources of information online. The only thing people trust less is like Rush Limbaugh and Al Jazeera Network. And frankly, they should trust Al Jazeera more. But I, you know, you saw this. I went to look at BuzzFeed again to see what they were up to. And it's so stupid. The 5 things that were on the page when I glanced there. Quiz, which album by Vampire Weekend are you? Vampire Weekend has 3 albums. 2 of them are the same. So it's like, it's not like you've got 20 albums and they cut a list. 10 totally true facts about North America. And then this is great. They mock it and they go, you'd probably brag too if you sneezed and created Hawaii. Oh, ha, that's a colony that we invaded and took over and deposed their government and, you know, installed our own puppet. That's the thing to be proud of. They're going to reference Hawaii. Oh, here's leprosy. Enjoy. I mean, this is the crap that they have on their website. Quiz, which of Rory Gilmore's boyfriends are you? She had 3. Yeah, I'm glad they're talking about Gilmore Girls, but she only had 3. It's not like, you know.
I'm looking at
I hate this stuff. I hate it.
I'm looking at the Daily Mail there. Now, their website has 2 suicides are linked to Ashley Madison leak. Texas police chief takes his own life just days after his email is leaked in cheating website hack. My email is on the Ashley Madison leak.
Is it?
Yeah, because you know what? My email is public, so anybody can, you know, use your email anywhere. So who knows whether this leak is actually...
Well, if you kill yourself, it's a good guess you actually were on Ashley Madison and actually were cheating on your wife. I think you should kill, you know, be more likely if you were on Grindr, you know, and your wife found out. That would seem to be more of a problem, but
yeah, well,
okay.
Whatever, yeah. I mean, whenever my email appears in any one of these big leaks, I'm like...
Did it literally appear on Ashley Madison?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's on there? Oh, that's hilarious.
I knew when they released that information, I was like, well, I'm sure at least one of the email addresses I own is on there because I know at least one address is everywhere. And so it's just every time there's a leak, I'm like, yeah,
awesome.
Sure I'll be there. And sure
you
enough.
You should put the list of all the scandals you're involved in. That's great.
Yeah.
My mom was at she has a breakfast club after her morning mass. She's Catholic. And all the folk who go to that 8:30 a.m. mass are gathered together and having a little chat. And one day Ashley Madison came up and they were all discussing it. My mom, you know, most of them didn't even know what is Ashley Madison's website where you cheat on your spouse. You just go on there. And my mom was just listening. She didn't know what it was. And she said, wait a second. You mean all I had to do was go to AshleyMadison.com?
Yeah, although,
and they all laughed.
I can tell you she would have been one of the few women on there. Now that all this information is coming out, it's like 86% men.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah.
And 14% working women.
Yeah, exactly. No,
professionals. So BuzzFeed is dead cool-wise because they've now been purchased by NBC, but oh well.
So other how about like 10 reasons to know your website's no longer hip?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well.
Well, you know, Daily Mail here. I love this in the Daily Mail. Wall Street free fall. Dow opens 1,000 points down in biggest fall ever after Chinese stock rout. But stocks partially recover by lunch. I love the fact that, like, you know what? The U.S. can't even beat China in down markets. You know, China still has a bigger down market than the U.S.
Yeah. And, of course, the devaluing of the Chinese currency is one reason why you saw the media companies and Wall Street taking a hit in general. They're all not sure about the instability of that market and what that means for the rest of the world. When they cough, we all pay attention.
Oh, I like the way you're working in your background ambient noises there. That's pretty good.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope nobody's dying back there, by the way.
Well, yeah, but some people have died this week. I'll do the first 2, and then you can lead off on the third. Batgirl died. Actress Yvonne Craig died at 78. She did other stuff. She was a very successful ballet dancer. She had a guest role on Star Trek where she was a green Orion slave girl. How cool is that? But of course, she will be known now and forever as Batgirl. And if you're a guy of a certain age, when you were a teenage boy, Batgirl was very important to you.
In fact, in 1974, and it just goes to show you how things have changed, here was the public service announcement that Batgirl starred in 1974.
A ticking bomb means trouble for Batman and Robin.
Holy, breaking and entering. It's Batgirl.
Quick, Batgirl, untie us before it's too late.
It's already too late. I've worked for you a long time, and I'm paid less than Robin. Same job, same employer means equal pay for men and women.
No time for jokes, Batgirl.
It's no joke. It's the federal equal pay law.
Holy act of Congress!
If you're not getting equal...
Come on, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. And you know what, Batgirl? She still hasn't defeated that villain.
Exactly. That's why I kind of play. I was like, oh, look at that. That's an interesting thing to bring up upon
us. That's the best clip you've had in a while. Also dead this week is Senegalese drummer Dudu Ndiaye Rose. I hope I'm saying his name right. Dudu Ndiaye Rose. I've seen his name a lot, but I haven't heard it pronounced a lot. He's a world-class drummer. He died at 85. He's one of the greats. He's a Senegalese master of many drums and percussion instruments, especially the sabar. But he played with everyone, from Peter Gabriel to Miles Davis. You probably have an album that's among your favorites that he has appeared on.
And finally, Bud Yorkin, who was a director and producer of, shows like All in the Family, Maude, Sanford and Son. He was always overshadowed by Norman Lear. He passed away at the age of 89.
That's right. He was a major player. Norman Lear paid tribute to him, even though there's a little contentiousness about who did what. But Norman Lear paid a fond and appropriate tribute to Bud Yorkin. He directed the pilot of All in the Family, directed these shows. And he was the guy who broke through first. He had a big success in early TV doing variety shows. He worked with the big stars like Martin and Lewis, you name it. And he wrote, produced, and directed An Evening with Fred Astaire, which was the first color musical special on primetime. And it was a smash hit, huge ratings draw. He won Emmys. It just was, you know, a monster success. And that helped him set up a company. And he invited Norman Lear and others to join him. And Norman Lear stepped in and they worked together. And they, of course, had great success. The big question is, who came up with All in the Family? Norman Lear says, I was reading TV Guide and read about this show in the UK. Called Till Death Do Us Part. Bud Yorkin says, I was in London, I saw the show, and I told him about it. Whatever happened, they both worked together on the pilot. They cast Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers and Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton. He directed the pilot. The network was still freaked out, but eventually went on the air, became
a huge hit.
Arguably the most successful, the biggest hit of all time in many ways, and most influential show. It was a monster hit. It didn't happen right away. It came in on the air, and then the reruns in the summers where it really caught fire. They had it on at 10 p.m. because they were so frightened, with a disclaimer, this show will talk about bad things. Yeah, they put it on at 8 o'clock, and it just took off like wildfire, and then that was it. CBS created its iconic Saturday night lineup. All in the Family, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, the Carol Burnett Show. They were all part of that lineup at one point or another. That's just one of the great lineups. All in the Family spun off a number of shows, and it changed television. Really, you can't say that enough in the what TV covered, what it talked about, what it did. I mean, All in the Family, Maude, the Jeffersons. I mean, it takes your breath away when you watch those early episodes. It really was groundbreaking television like few others.
Well, I should point out An Evening with Fred Astaire getting all those big ratings and everything. It was produced in 1958. OK, so there wasn't much else on.
That's true, but it still did well.
Yeah,
instead of 30 million people watching, 60 million people watched. Bud Yorkin did other stuff. He always wanted to have a success in movies, never had quite the same success. A little bit early on with a Neil Simon play and this and that and the other thing, but he did do a movie I like. He did Arthur 2, Arthur on the Rocks, the sequel to Arthur, and he really should not have done that. But he did do Twice in a Lifetime, which is a little movie with Gene Hackman about a man who divorces his wife like after 30 years of marriage. And I always have fond memories of that movie. I thought it was a very nice, low-key movie. Came and went. Nobody paid attention to it, but I think it's a real gem, so you might check it out. And he saved Blade Runner. That movie, Ridley Scott film, was really falling apart, and he stepped in with money and was an executive producer on it and helped make that film happen, and his much-dreamed-about sequel to that is finally coming together, and it's going to happen, and he knew that was happening before he died. So he knew that he had other new things in the works. But he was not a big guy for the spotlight, unlike Norman Lear, who was a real good guy who loves the spotlight and can talk about all sorts of issues. So he didn't get quite the same credit, and Lear would be the first to say he deserved much credit as well.
Well, and Mr. Yorkin always complained that he had never seen a dime from Blade Runner because apparently
it didn't make any money. That's
right,
why
exactly.
I didn't see a dime.
I'm kidding.
Movie didn't make any. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Now you said that the Batgirl clip was the best clip I'd you know, played in a while. What about this clip?
I have a headache.
It might be a tumor.
It's not a tumor. Not a tumor at all.
Come on. We're ending the show as we began it.
No? All right. And if they're done and I have nothing. Okay. Finish.
Finish. Okay. Well, if you did not like that clip, you know, I played one good one. I had to play one bad one, I suppose. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. You can follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our username, or like us on Facebook. You can search for Showbiz Sandbox to find our page. Of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, as well as all the links to the stories that we've discussed on today's episode. You can find them all on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Well, I've launched two this week. I've launched onedirectionforever.com, which actually probably is a website. And, of course, it's nadatuma.com.
I think that probably also is a website. And if you can't find any of Michael's work there, he's already mentioned that you can find some of his coverage of the entertainment industry at HuffingtonPost.com, but you can also find it at MichaelGiltz.com, or you can always head over to BookFilter.com to see what Michael's picks for the latest and greatest books are. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
What if it is a tumor?